Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast this week is Richard Bergen, MP. Richard originates from Leeds. He's a Member of Parliament for the Labour Party. Richard, it's fabulous to welcome you to the Godcast. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm not so bad, thanks, Alex. Do you prefer Alex or Father Alex?
Just call me Alex. That's absolutely fine.
No, it's
So,
great to see you.
Richard, are you a Yorkshireman born and bred? Just tell us a bit about those early days.
Yeah, so I'm from Leeds, so Yorkshire is very important to me, and I went away to university for 3 years, but apart from that, I've lived in Leeds all my life, so it's really great for me to represent the constituency that my family are from. And my family have lived in this part of Leeds for 100 years since coming over as immigrants from Ireland looking for work, because the part of Leeds that I represent includes the place, it was called the Bank at the time, where Irish immigrants disproportionately came to that part of Leeds when they came to Leeds. So, yeah, Leeds born and bred, follow Leeds United, and really pleased to be able to represent the community I'm from down in Parliament.
I've already gone off piste here, Richard, but a bit of a colloquial question. I mean, I'm from Burnley in Lancashire. I worked in Huddersfield for a period of time, and they were just the best times. They were wonderful people. But I think the Lancastrians and the Yorkshire, though we like to play up this difference, there's many, many similarities, aren't there?
Oh, definitely. The north's the north, as they say. And I love going across the Pennines and those lovely Pennine towns with the fantastic stone they've got. I was at my friend's a school friend's 40th birthday party the other Saturday night, and it was in Todmorden, which of course is on the very border between
Yeah.
Lancashire and Yorkshire. I remember as a kid, I used to love going to a bookshop there. I don't know if it's still there now, called the Border Bookshop, and there it was a second-hand bookshop, and the idea fascinated me of this town being on the very border between two counties. So we've got a lot in common, Lancashire and Yorkshire. And so I think the only thing we won't agree on is between Lancashire and Yorkshire is the Leeds United Manchester United rivalry. Whereas we're more obsessed with Man United than they are with us. They're probably, unfortunately, view us at the moment as a bit of an irrelevance, but hopefully that'll change.
Well, as a Burnley fan, I don't care about either of your teams. Although you have got one of our players on loan at the moment, Roberts has just joined your team on loan from us. So,
The thing about Burnley that all Leeds United fans remember is the famous all-time great goal by Eddie Gray in the 1970s against Burnley. He scored two, I think we won 4-2. He scored two goals in the match, but is that famous goal where he was dribbling it around so many Burnley players and doing the kind of back drags and stuff. And that's the kind of video that us sad Leeds fans watch again and again and again, reliving past glories, hoping and praying to come.
Well,
And of course,
we're going down a rabbit hole here, because one of another connection is Brian Flynn, who is a great Burnley legend. He's also a great legend for Leeds United, who played for Wales and I think captain managed Wales for a period of time as well. But anyway, that's enough of football, and let's just touch a bit on the God stuff, Richard. You went to a Roman Catholic school. This is correct, isn't it? And you were the head boy there. Just tell us about those days in that capacity.
yes, I was at Sir Cardinal Lehinen High School in Meanwood in Leeds. And yeah, I was a head boy there. And I went on the pilgrimage to Lourdes when I was in year 10. And in fact, what happened is two kind of pupils, every two pupils were put together in a team and set about to kind of look after a pilgrim. And so we looked after this bloke from Huddersfield, a really nice old lad from Huddersfield in a wheelchair. And I remember him sending us a postal order when we got back to school from Lourdes, thanking us for the help we'd given him. It really touched me at the time. I'll never forget that. It was a really interesting, moving experience. I've still got on my wall, actually, in my dad's house, not in my house, but on the wall in my dad's house is the photo of all all the school people from Leeds that went to Lourdes on that occasion. It must have been in 1996. We're all in these kind of yellow jerseys, you know, hundreds and hundreds of us. It was, you know, a really fantastic moving experience.
And you were quite an academic young guy, I guess. You held the lofty position of head boy. What responsibilities went with that in terms of the link to the Roman Catholic worship.
I'm not sure that there were that many links to that aspect. We sometimes had to do things in assemblies. I don't think that the head boy and head girl had kind of any kind of religious responsibilities. And even though it was a Catholic school, I suppose the kind of ethos permeated the school. We all had to do religious education as one of our GCSEs. But the only kind of compulsory masses, I think, was, you know, once a term where you'd have whole school mass. They did have mass every week on a lunchtime that people could go to if they wanted. But it was kind of light touch. I mean, my dad went to a Catholic school, and some of the stories he tells me, he's in his late 70s now, about how the nuns used to behave back in the 1950s. I mean, it was nothing like that, you know, kind of cross-examining pupils on whether they'd been to mass on Sunday and had heard the sermon. And, you know, he talks about kind of being knocked about by nuns and things, saying, you know, God is love. Remember, yeah. God is love. Awful, really. But obviously that was a different era. Cardinal Heenan High School in Leeds, a fantastic school. I was really pleased to go back a few years ago and give some awards, which made me feel strange, especially because a couple of the teachers who taught me were still there, which felt weird. And there's even like a pupil I went to school with there who is now a teacher there. Back at the school we went to. No, it's a fantastic school, a fantastic community. And it always stressed the kind of New Testament, love your neighbour as you love yourself, the Beatitudes and all that kind of thing, which I think whether somebody's religious or not, it's the moral message of it is very important and very useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly would advocate people looking up their Beatitudes, even if you're not somebody of faith. I was going to ask, Richard, you went on to Cambridge University. Was that your destination? Were you always destined for such dizzy heights of academia, or did it, was there an element of good fortune? Just tell us about that.
Well, I think anything that you achieve in life, there's an element of good fortune in it, isn't there? And good fortune comes in all sorts of ways. But I was encouraged at sixth form to apply. I hadn't thought of it. And then I applied and I got in. And I remember it, yes, it felt a bit like a culture shock being down there, but it was enjoyable. It was useful. In a strange way, I think I'd valued educational experience down there even more now than I did then. Because when you're kind of 18, 19 years, 20 years old, there are other things you want to do other than read books. And I just think that I'd probably value even more now, especially once you've been in the world of work for years. You kind of then realise how lucky you are to be writing three essays a week and reading three or four books a week. At the time, it felt like a real bind. You know, it's so stressful, got to do three essays this week. Got to read Ulysses this week. It seemed, got to read medieval literature this week. It seemed a real kind of imposition on my youthful life. But once you've been in work day in, day out for years, then I think you take a different view on these things. I'd love to do something like that again. So I don't think I do enough reading anymore. Now, you know, read a fair few books, but I'm guilty of spending too much time scrolling political social media on an evening rather than reading a book. And, you know, reading books is such a fantastic relaxation and such a kind of journey for the mind, takes you out of the present, helps you to reflect upon the world and on your own life, helps you to relax as well. You know, total escapism.
Yeah. And was your interest in politics aroused at university, or was it before that? Was it back at school? Just tell us how you...
I was always interested in politics because my parents were teachers, and growing up I used to hear them moaning, quite rightly I'd say, about Thatcher and how awful she was. And I was born in 1980, so I remember then my mum and dad talking at the dinner table about how they didn't like Thatcher and the Tories. And then my uncle, who later became a Labour MP, was political active. He became a Labour MP. He was very involved in supporting the striking miners in 1984 to 85 in Allerton Bywater, which is not far from East Leeds, where I live. And my auntie as well, she was the wife at the time of a striking miner and active in the Women Against Pick Closures. So I grew up hearing about all of this. And I think that growing up hearing about the miners' strike in particular, that got me thinking about how the way society works, because it seemed to me to be, even as a young person, to be a clear example of two different competing visions for society, and an example of what the Conservative government would do to working class people if they stood up for a better way forward. And so I kind of grew up listening to all of that, and that meant I was very interested in politics. I vaguely remember Labour losing in 1992, unfortunately, when we thought we were going to win. And I remember hearing adults talking about Kinnock's speech at the Sheffield rally, and how it was used. I then remember, I think I was in a school play on the night of the 1997 general election. So I remember after the school play, which was Oh, What a Lovely War, in which I played the vicar, by the way. It's like the nearest I got to a person in the club. I played the vicar in a kind of Mickey taking way, which people found funny, but I think maybe some people didn't quite like. But I remember going home after that and staying up watching the election results. So I'll have been 15 or 16 at the 16 or 17 or 16 or 15 or 16 at the time. And so I was always kind of hearing people talk about politics. And then what I would say though is that when I went to university, that going down to Cambridge made me, I think that made certain I'd always be a political activist. I do view myself as still as a political activist, even though I'm a member of Parliament. My experience at university down at Cambridge made certain I'd always want to be involved in politics in one way or another. I don't mean by being an MP, I just mean by doing politics in my spare time outside work, because I went to university with people, I gained the impression that they'd be running society. And I thought to myself, these people I'm meeting are no cleverer than or better than the people I went to school with at Cardinal Heaney and in Meanwood in Leeds. But because of their connections and their confidence, they're going to end up running society, whether that's through politics, the media, or business, or in the law. I thought, why should we leave it to them? Why should we leave it to them to do that? We should have a go ourselves. And I just thought as well, lots of the people I went to school with wouldn't have believed some of these people I met at university existed. They'd probably only seen them in a Harry Enfield sketch or whatever. So that made certain I'd always been involved, one way or other, politically active.
And what do you think it was, Richard, about the miners' strike? A gentleman I interviewed before this interview was with a guy called Boff Whalley. You might know Boff Whalley. He's a member
Oh,
of
yeah.
Chumbawamba, who originates from Burnley but has lots of connections to Yorkshire and Leeds. He's a bit older than I am, and I'm a bit older than you are, but we all have this kind of, I don't know if it's a fascination or an intrigue about the miners' strike. What was it, do you think, that evoked so much ill feeling on both sides of the political argument about that?
I think it was a stark kind of depiction of class divisions in society, things that we all know exist under the surface or feel exist under the surface, but were brought out into the open. And when you see the images of, for example, the police at Orgreave and the miners at Orgreave, the brutal way the police there treated the striking miners, it was this kind of visceral, I wouldn't say depiction, but a visceral kind of unmasking of the class reality of society. And we saw people being treated so badly. We also saw the best in people. I think that's what attracted me to finding out more about it as well. The way the communities came together in soup kitchens, the way that ethnic minority communities, because when you speak to striking miners, people who were striking miners, they often talk about this, about the Sikh shopkeepers, for example, donating tins of food. And when you see the lesbian and gays support the miners group, different people have been oppressed coming together to support people going through a really hard time when they're on strike for a year, often on £1 strike pay per day, having to go to community food kitchens. The state and Thatcher were out to get them. I think it showed both the best and worst of our society. And I think that's why people find it so fascinating. The light's coming through. Do you want me to draw the curtain?
Yeah, well, if anybody's watching, the light is shining on Richard as we speak. Yeah, just do the curtains and I'll just
I'll
pause
be
this.
back in a
So we're back in the room. This, you can tell this isn't the BBC or ITV. This is just localized podcasting, but very real and authentic.
Seamless. I've closed the curtain, the sun's not shining through, and we're good to proceed.
Okay, well, let's do that. So, Richard, you are famous. You are renowned for being on the left of the Labour Party. Have you? I sometimes wonder. Have you ever thought, I've got it wrong here? You know, what keeps you to the left of centre? Just
That's a
explain that
really
if you
good
could.
question. I think we all question our beliefs and analyses all the time. If we don't, there's something wrong. And that's why I enjoy debating. That's why I enjoy reading books written by people I don't agree with, because it helps you to test out your own ideas. But look, you know, we live in one of the richest countries on earth, but a country that's scarred by unnecessary poverty. And the constituency that I live in and represent is one of the most economically deprived constituencies in the country. And when you go to food banks here, when you see the conditions people live in, when I hear the stories people tell me when they come to my constituency advice sessions, then we all can agree that something's wrong. So the question comes, if something's fundamentally wrong, what do we do about it? And I don't think it's inevitable. I don't think it's inevitable that in one of the richest countries on earth, people should have to live like this. And so that's why I'm a socialist, because I think there's a different way of organizing the economy, of organizing society, which would enable everyone to reach their full potential and everyone to have that freedom that they deserve. And so that's why I'm a socialist. When I was growing up, Tony Benn was my great political hero. Reading his diaries, reading his speeches, watching his speeches, going to meetings to see him speak. And he spoke about the need for a radical transformation of society. And I do believe in that. And I actually believe in it more than I've ever believed in it before. And they say that as people get older, they get more right wing. Well, Tony Benn didn't. And I think I am more confident in my socialist beliefs than I've ever been. For example, if you look at the climate crisis, that shows to me and it affirms my belief that if the golden rule in the way society is run is the pursuit of profit, then that's very dangerous for us all. I think we've seen these big fossil fuel companies who have known for decades from their best scientists about the danger that their activities are causing to the climate, to animal species, and to the future of humanity. They've ploughed on regardless because they're wanting to maximize profits for their shareholders. And I think that climate change is the best, or rather the worst, example of the cost of pursuit for profit. It's like the example of the failure of a politics that's just about leaving it to the market. And so I'm confident in my socialist beliefs. Does that mean I get it right on each and every issue? Certainly not. And we all rethink things, we all make mistakes, but the overall vision of a society run for the public good, not for the private profit of some billionaires at the top. I think that's something that more and more people agree with, and I feel very, very strongly about it.
Yeah, you know, I'm a priest working in a very deprived area of Burnley, Richard, and the book that I plugged at the beginning of this podcast is about social injustice and poverty. And people sometimes assume that because I have a voice for that and I speak out against that, that I'm naturally a left-wing socialist. But I perhaps describe myself as a right-wing socialist, if there's such a thing. You know, I do believe that people should have aspiration and opportunity. But I also think there's a lot of apathy towards politicians. There's a lot of distrust. And I wonder if that's because when we look at social injustice and we look at poverty in places like Burnley and Leeds and Blackpool or Bradford, wherever it might be, and we are one of the richest economies in the world, but nobody has solved it. I mean, I've grown up in Burnley. I remember a very well-respected Labour MP called Peter Pike, who represented this time for a number of years. But I also recognise that I've growing up in this town, I've never known the town not to have issues with poverty. I can remember them from since I was a little boy. And I would imagine that's the case for you as well, Richard, in Leeds. And so we are one of the richest economies. And we need to create wealth because that keeps us going, but we can't solve poverty. And I find it very difficult to pin my colours to a political party because they don't really, I don't genuinely feel they seem to take that matter very seriously or not seriously enough. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Well, I think it's no bad thing for a priest not to pin their colours to the mast of a political party. I think it's far easier for you to do your job amongst a congregation if you have that kind of distance from that particular political choice, perhaps. But, you know, you're right, poverty's always existed, but it came to a certain point in the development of capitalism where poverty was no longer inevitable or necessary, when the amount of wealth generated in society was sufficient to ensure that every person had a decent standard of living, a decent house, a decent roof above their head, could afford to eat well and healthily, and afford to have a decent standard of living. But despite that being the case, that hasn't come about. And so I think that things have actually got worse for people in the last 40 years. Some of the things, so I was born in 1980, but when I listen to people who are kind of teenagers or young adults in the 1970s, certain things that they understandably took for granted in the 1970s would seem like pipe dreams to young people now. People used to walk into jobs, many of which were well-paid manufacturing jobs. People used to be able to get a council house far more easily. People used to be able to afford a mortgage far more easily. It wasn't seen as a pipe dream. So if you look at the number of people who, in their late 30s and beyond, are still living with their parents, not out of choice, but out of financial necessity, that would have been unthinkable by and large in the 1970s. And we're a wealthier country now in the 1970s. So something's obviously going very wrong. I think both on a material basis and on a moral basis, the searing inequality in our society really disturbs me. I was talking with a friend the other day about Keir Hardie's book, From Serfdom to Socialism. And in that, it kind of talks about the wealthiest 5%. Well, now we don't talk about that. We really talk about the wealthiest 1%, because the concentration of wealth has gone into fewer and fewer hands. The concentration of wealth has become concentrated in the hands of a smaller number of incredibly wealthy people. And you look how well billionaires, for example, have done in the UK in recent years, and the increased share of the wealth they've got. So I don't think poverty is inevitable. And I think that people will have hope and people will be able to reach their full potential if things change. Otherwise, what you end up with in an unequal society, such an unequal society, is more people feeling totally disfranchised from the political system, but also from the kind of economic life of the country as well. And that's bad for social cohesion, it's bad for communities, and it's bad for individuals as well.
Yeah, I agree with most of that. And you know, I sometimes think the House of Westminster have got similar problems to the Church of England in their huge institutions that try and be all things to all people and can't. We've got, you will be aware of the disputes raging in the Church of England about same-sex relationships, et cetera, et cetera. Is it, you know, and I don't want to get into the Keir Starmer leadership. This is about you, Richard, but do you think it's important that alternative voices are heard within institutions and political organisations and boardrooms, etc.? I certainly do, but I'm keen to hear what you think.
Yeah, I think a diversity of opinion is important in any organisation, because if we all agree with each other all the time, then by definition things just stay the same. And sometimes if things stay the same, that actually leads to them getting worse, because you're not adapting to new challenges and new perspectives. I mean, you mentioned the Church of England. I'll mention then the Catholic Church. The current Pope has different opinions, different ways of expressing himself compared to his predecessor. Now that's a good thing. So not every leader of an institution has exactly the same opinions. Not everyone within that institution has the same opinions. And when it comes to the Labour Party, I remember the joke by Tony Benn. He said that the Labour Party is a bit like the church. He says the Labour Party has some socialists in it, like the church has some Christians in it. Obviously, I couldn't comment or pass judgment on either of those things, but there's a funny thing that Tony Benn said. But when it comes to the Labour Party or any political party or Parliament as a whole, I think it's important that there is that diversity of opinion. And that's what Parliament's meant to be about, isn't it? Because people are meant to be going there to express views they've arrived upon, largely through the experience of their own constituents who come to see them every weekend. And that's why I think it's really important to be back in your constituency on your weekend. So I come home to Leeds, usually on a Thursday. And obviously when you first elect to Parliament, you think you'll never get out of touch, you'll never sell out and the rest of it. Most MPs, I mean, I don't know any MP who like wakes up one morning and goes, do you know what? I'm going to sell out to my beliefs. Do you know what? I'm going to get out of touch with my roots. It can happen without you realising it, because by definition, Parliament, although it's in a representative democracy, Parliament itself as an institution isn't representative or isn't sufficiently representative of our society. And you can end up in the Westminster Ivory Tower if you're not careful. So I think it's a real important thing for all MPs to get back to the communities. And we all represent communities, yes, which have a lot in common, but every community is a bit different as well. And it's in Parliament's meant to be about bringing to Parliament that plethora of different experiences and different voices. And that's good for our democracy and good for our society. And obviously, it'd be really boring if we agreed with each other all the time. There'd be no need for any debates. And people do shift their opinion on things. And that's, well, I think one thing in politics we need to do is to remove this kind of stigma about changing your mind, which is like a gotcha moment if you're on the TV. And you say, oh, you're saying this now, but you didn't support this policy 2 years ago. And MPs are often kind of encouraged to kind of make out they haven't changed their mind. It'd be great if you just said, you know what, I thought that then, but actually I realised I was wrong. And now I've got a different position. Because that's everyone else in society. That's how we operate in our lives. Things change and our opinions change as a result of them. Our understanding changes. So I think the diversity of voices is important. But also, MPs, we should stop having to pretend that we're somehow infallible, because we're certainly not. And why should we be?
I think it's a really important point, because I think... you know, and I think media has got its responsibility to take in this, is that it creates kind of a tribalistic style about it. I mean, there's very few media programs out there, Richard, that would actually just have a conversation like this for 30 minutes, just talking and understanding where you might come from or whatever. Normally, it's a case of Labour against the Conservative, and, you know, this, they light the torch paper and off they go. You know, do you think there should be room for a bit more joined up thinking and less vitriol in the chamber and in politics in general?
I'm all for big battles of ideas, because I think out of that can come something better. But what I don't like is where it almost feels like an act, where it's just where the kind of froth or fury it isn't due to real differences, but it's just a kind of tribalistic thing. I'm not as keen on that. But when it comes to TV, I was watching, it shows how sad I am, I was watching some old interviews from the 70s and 80s of different MPs. And what amazed me, looking back at some of the old political discussion programmes on television, were that they actually were discussion programmes, like people could finish the sentences and people give discursive answers. And actually, through doing that, you actually got more out of the MPs in terms of what are they actually thinking. I think it did a better service to democracy and a better service to the public. So it allowed the interviewer to really probe what the politician actually thought. And, you know, there's that old phrase, you know, give someone in a rope, tangle themselves or whatever. Also, you let somebody speak, then things come out which you might not have wanted to share with the public, which can be a good thing for transparency as well. I think now there's so much of this kind of people trying on TV trying to copy or be modern versions of Jeremy Paxman that it not that I'm saying MPs in any way, which you feel sorry for them, but MPs think often go into these interviews feeling utterly vigilant, trying to anticipate what the second question will be when the first one's being asked. You know, are they only asking me this so they can therefore ask me that? And it leads to politicians being cagey and people don't like that. And it doesn't lead to people having a greater understanding what different political parties and different politicians think. And so I do wonder if political shows would be more popular if the guests were given a bit more time to breathe. Not, and I'm not asking people to go soft on politicians. We need to be held to account and held to account rigorously. What I mean is, it'd be more like almost like a television version of a town hall meeting or whatever, where the people on the panel will get to answer questions at length and there'll be more chance for questions. I suppose in a way that lots of the podcasts have stepped into that space, you know, not going for the short clip, gotcha clips to go viral, but actually having longer discussions that can tease out different nuances in people's ideas and experiences, which can only be a good thing for our democracy, and help people to make informed choices when they vote as well.
And just I've really enjoyed chatting to you, Richard. Just a few things to kind of bring this to a close. The big year for the general election, it's almost certainly going to be later in the year. Expectation high within the Labour Party, would you say?
Well, we're really wanting to win after 14 years of the Tories being in charge and doing so much damage. But, you know, we can't take it for granted. I mentioned earlier in the interview, I remember as an 11 or 12-year-old hearing the news from my family that Labour unfortunately lost the 92 election when lots of people thought we were going to win. So, I mean, I was out campaigning this week in my own constituency, delivering my residents' reports, talking to people. I really enjoy that. I enjoy the general election period because you get to have more contact with the public and people are more up for discussing political issues with you. And that's great fun. But yeah, hopefully we'll win, but we can't take it for granted. And something that does worry me is how nasty the general election might become. And maybe you can't comment because quite rightly, you know, you're not particularly partisan when it comes to political parties, but I see the government has been very desperate. And I think we saw at Prime Minister's Question Time the other week, the Prime Minister made this anti-trans jibe, and it was awful. And I'm worried we'll see more of that kind of thing. The kind of people call it the culture wars, but really it's scapegoating vulnerable minorities, whether it be trans people, whether it be asylum seekers. And I do worry that the more desperate the government gets, the nasty the political discourse will become in the run-up to the general election. At the same time, of course, we've got the run-up to the presidential election in the United States, and some of the narratives that Donald Trump is pushing are truly horrifying. And I think back to when I was younger, and I used to kind of go campaigning in places against the BNP, where like the BNP might take council seats or even a parliamentary seat. And some of the things were being said by BNP candidates are now being saying are now being said by prominent Conservative Party politicians, by MPs in the Conservative Party, and are being said by people like Donald Trump, who is running to be once again the most powerful person on earth. This mainstreaming of these scapegoating ideas really worries me, and I'm worried it'll intensify in the run-up to general election. So we need to do something about that.
And finally, Richard, I mean, the world is a very dangerous place, and you've touched on Donald Trump there being a very scary proposition for the future. And I just want to finish on the Holy Land. I've been to Palestine and Israel twice in the last 5 years. I've become very attached to it by the experience. And you know, people are going to go, he's not asked him about Corbyn because you are closely aligned to Jeremy. But what's your, not political view, but your personal view on what I can quite easily say is an absolute atrocity that's happening in the West Bank? How do you see it, Richard?
Well, it is horrifying, isn't it? And nobody, whatever their politics, whatever their usual positions on the questions in the Middle East, should be anything other than horrified at the human suffering we've seen. You know, we saw the massacre of Israeli civilians on October the 7th. We know that people are being held hostage in appalling conditions, and we see the deaths of 30,000 and counting civilians in Gaza, and then we see what's happening in the West Bank as well, with settlers abusing Palestinians. It's awful. And I think we've all got to do whatever we can to argue for and put pressure on for an immediate ceasefire, which would save lives, get the hostages out, and then try and build a peace there, you know, around a two-state solution. People are seeing this horror unfold on the media and on social media, and it's really, really heartbreaking, isn't it? And it's made me think that it reminds us of the real necessity for a politics of peace in Parliament. And I mean, I don't class myself as religious now, but I did pop into church a few months ago to the old Catholic church in Leeds I used to go to, the Immaculate Heart. And what interested me was there was the overt language of peace that was being talked about in relation to this. Symbols of peace, the dove, discussion of peace. I think we need to get back to that and do everything we can as politicians to end the suffering and end the conflict. And that's, you mentioned earlier about people losing hope in politics. This is another reason. If this can't be ended, and if this doesn't end, people can ask big questions about the political system.
Yeah, hear, hear to that, Richard. Thank you. Thanks so much for your time. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. I know you're a busy man, and anybody who's watching this Godcast and is enjoying a political discussion, there are loads of politicians on the Godcast from all parties, Conservative, Labour, left, right, something for everybody. So, Richard, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Wish you well, and God bless you, and thanks for coming on the Godcast.
And to you too.